This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with our own Stephen Rohde about how Donald Trump is exploiting the nation's 250th anniversary to whitewash American history and impose a reactionary, exclusionary vision of the founding.
I'll examine what's really at stake and how we, the people, have to respond with our own truthful, honest story of the American founding.
As a real-time example of the kind of activism Stephen calls for, we'll also hear a first-hand account about a mass protest on January 23rd in Minneapolis against ICE violence and murders on the day before the killing of ICU nurse Alex Preti.
Our guest is Shandor John, a faculty leader at the City University of New York's Professional Staff Congress.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
2026 is the 250th anniversary of signing of the Declaration of Independence and the founding of the United States of America. Festivities and events are being organized all over the country all year long. Here at Law and Disorder, we intend to invite guests throughout the year who can help us explore the founding of our country in a way that is truthful, authentic, and comprehensive. But like so much else in these dangerous times, Donald Trump is ruining this rare opportunity to celebrate the enduring values of pluralism, justice, and equality on which this country was founded. Instead, Trump is enlisting the entire federal government and billions of public and private dollars into converting this national anniversary into an opportunity to whitewash American history, pursuing his obsession to destroy diversity, equity, and inclusion, crushing institutions like the Smithsonian Museums that for 175 years has served as, quote, a welcoming place of knowledge and discovery for all Americans, and imposing his reactionary vision of white Christian nationalism. Seeing how Trump is already exploiting the 250th anniversary of the founding by peddling his distorted version of American history, our very own co-host Steve Rohde has been investigating what Trump is doing and how the rest of us need to redouble our efforts to immerse ourselves and the American people in an accurate and comprehensive account of our history. Stephen Rohde is a writer, lecturer, and political activist. For almost 50 years, he practiced civil rights, civil liberties, and intellectual property law. He's a past chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California and past national chair of Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. He is a founder and current chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, a member of the board of directors of Death Penalty Focus, and a member of the Black Jewish Justice Alliance. He is the special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Stephen is the author of the book American Words of Freedom, The Words That Define Our Nation, and Freedom of Assembly, as well as numerous articles and book reviews on civil liberties and constitutional history. Stephen, welcome to the guest seat on Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you so much, Heidi. I'm very pleased to be with you in this role today.
Stephen, plans to celebrate the 250th anniversary of this country have been in the works well before Trump took office. Tell us what those plans look like before he got his hands on them.
Yes, originally the plans to celebrate the 250th commemoration were launched by President Barack Obama. In 2016, he signed an act of Congress creating a bipartisan United States semi-quincentennial commission. The first set of commissioners were a highly diverse group of Democrats and Republicans. including 8 members of Congress, 16 private citizens, 9 federal officials. And in 2018, Rosa Guantoyo Toyo Rios, a Mexican-American business leader who had served as the 43rd treasurer of the United States under Obama, was named a commissioner. And in July 2022, President Joe Biden appointed her to chair the commission. So it was in the works. It was fully bipartisan, but that's changed.
Yes, we know that bipartisan congressional commissions are not a Trump thing. So tell us what he's planning and how it contrasts with what has been underway for nearly 10 years.
Well, as we've seen all year, within about a week after taking office the second time, on January 29 last year, by executive order, he established his own separate White House task force on celebrating America's 250th birthday. This is known as the Task Force 250. Of course, he appointed himself as chair and Vice President J.D. Vance as vice chair. Trump granted himself the power to appoint an executive director. And to ensure that Task Force 250 was securely anchored within the Republican Party, he stacked the initial task force with 14 Republicans that he had previously appointed in his administration, and the heads of other executive departments as he may choose to invite to participate. The official bipartisan commission, the one appointed by Obama, will play no official part in Task Force 250. It may be, quote, invited to provide recommendations and advice. Trump also reinstated Executive Order 13978, which he had issued during his first term, titled Building the National Garden of American Heroes. Biden had canceled that immediately after he became president. In Trump's executive order, he complained that across the nation, quote, belief in the greatness and goodness of America has come under attack in recent months and years by a dangerous anti-American extremism that seeks to dismantle our country's history, institutions, and very identity. This is the theme. We'll be hearing it throughout this conversation. He speaks in those terms when he is the one who is dismantling our history, our institutions, and our very identity.
You know, Steve, I can't help but notice that Task Force 250 sounds like a military operation.
You're right.
Trump's made his true intentions quite apparent in a subsequent March 27, 2025 executive order titled Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History. Tell us about that.
Yes, whatever whitewashing, if you will, of his initial declaration, this one is Trump on steroids. He complained that over the past decade, quote, Americans have witnessed a concerted and widespread effort to rewrite our national history, replacing objective facts with a distorted narrative driven by ideology rather than truth. You know, in what Trump does, there's always a lot of projection of his own motives he then attributes to others. In this executive order, he accused this, quote, revisionist movement of undermining the remarkable achievements of the United States by casting founding principles and milestones in a negative light. You're going to see that a lot. True history for him is negative because it tells the truth. He accused this movement of reconstructing American history, quote, as inherently racist, sexist, oppressive, or otherwise irredeemably flawed. Well, that's the point. He wants to remove any history of racism, sexism, oppression, and have this prettified history that is literally pure white. He accused the Biden administration of advancing a corrosive ideology because they sponsored. He gave an example. There was a training at the Independence National Historical Park in Philadelphia. This was under the Biden administration, in which there was a training speaking about dismantling Western foundations and interrogating institutional racism. You know, those, of course, are what a healthy country should do. But Trump condemned them. And he condemned the Smithsonian Institute for coming under the, quote, influence of a divisive, race-centered ideology that promotes, quote, narratives that portray American and Western values as inherently harmful and oppressive. You know, whenever I see language like that, that our side is introducing a race-centered ideology, The race-centered ideology at the heart of our nation was introduced by slavery and the annihilation of Native Americans. They introduced race into this country in such a terrible way. And when we try to tell that story and overcome the white supremacist narrative, then we are accused of divisiveness. That's what we're really up against in the 250th under Trump.
Well, in one case related to the museum, Trump criticized the Smithsonian American Art Museum for mounting the exhibit called The Shape of Power, Stories of Race in American Sculpture, that asserts that, quote, societies including the United States have used race to establish and maintain systems of power, privilege, and disenfranchisement, end quote. The exhibit further explains that, quote, sculpture has been a powerful tool in promoting scientific racism and promotes the view that race is not a biological reality but a social construct, stating, quote, race is a human invention. How has Trump targeted the Smithsonian specifically?
Yes, this is ongoing. It's current as we speak, and I'll discuss that. And it's a very dangerous approach to our American history, going after this esteemed set of multiple museums that make up the Smithsonian and that has been at this work for 175 years. Trump declared that it's the policy of his administration to restore federal sites dedicated to history, including solemn and uplifting public monuments that remind Americans of our extraordinary heritage and the like. But in the very same breath, his executive order had the audacity to announce that henceforth museums in our national capital, quote, should be places where individuals go to learn, not to be subjected to ideological indoctrination or divisive narratives that distort or shared history, our shared history, unquote. I mean, he is saying out loud exactly what he's doing. So he empowered Vance. Now, the vice president, all vice presidents in recent memory have a role as a member of the Smithsonian Board of Regents. That's a job, one of the jobs the vice president has. Well, that has never been as weaponized as it is now. So Vance sits on that board, and under this executive order, he is instructed to work with Congress to ensure that future appropriations to the Smithsonian Institute, quote, prohibit expenditure on exhibits that, quote, degrade shared American values, quote, divide Americans based on race, or promote programs or ideologies inconsistent with federal law and policy. Well, they are moving ahead on this. Last August, three Trump officials sent a long letter to Lonnie G. Bunch III, secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. And they launched an internal review of all Smithsonian exhibits and materials to celebrate the 250th. They told Bunch that it's important, more important than ever, that our national museums reflect the unity, progress, and enduring values. They told the Smithsonian to follow the Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History executive order, which I quoted earlier. This review is breathtakingly wide and intrusive. It will focus on all exhibition text, wall didactics, websites, educational material, digital and social media. They will interview curators and senior staff to interrogate them on whether they are following the president's mission. And it will be done in consistent with guidelines set by the president rather than the independent guidelines that have driven the Smithsonian ever since it was established.
Stephen, in conjunction with the online publication LA Progressive, as contributing editor, you're planning a year-to-year look at the Declaration of Independence. The series is titled All Men Are Created Equal, Hypocrisy or Hope. Your upcoming inaugural article in LA Progressive recommends that one of the best ways to celebrate the 250th anniversary is to recall the words of Frederick Douglass, Susan B. Anthony, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Give us a sample of how they viewed the Declaration of Independence.
Yes, in launching this program, and I'm so grateful to Dick Price and Sharon Kyle of LA Progressive for being open to having some of their most talented writers across this year devoted to these serious questions. You know, was our founding document mere hypocrisy written by slave owners, or is it an essential expression of aspirations and hope that the people have struggled to breathe life into for the last 250 years? And I've said this in groups that I'm active in with Indivisible and the ACLU and others. We cannot just be against what Trump is doing in this 250th anniversary in particular, but more broadly in his entire fascist agenda, just to be against what he's doing. We have to be for something. We have to be in favor of a vision, in this case, of American history. And we have to offer readers and listeners and the American people alternatives. We have to be the ones to demonstrate the comprehensive, complex nature of American history. And I couldn't think of starting at a better place than Frederick Douglass, Susan B. Anthony, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. They understood the complexities of American history. They were the victims of the most oppressive aspects of that history. Yet they could tenaciously believe that America was founded upon indelible revolutionary principles. And they insisted that the American government and the American people live up to those principles. And I think that's exactly what we need to be doing this whole year and frankly, every year. So I went back, and of course, those three towering figures are not the only ones, and I hope in local libraries and community events and on July 4th itself and elsewhere throughout this year, everybody seek out examples of the kinds of visionary leaders that these three individuals represent. I went back and looked at an extraordinary speech that Frederick Douglass gave called What to a Slave is the 4th of July. Douglass, born an enslaved person in Maryland. He later escaped into freedom and emerged as really one of the leading abolitionist voices in the 19th century. In June of 1852, as July 4th was approaching, he delivered an Independence Day address to the Rochester Ladies Anti-Slavery Society. And he didn't mince words. He criticized the gap between American founding principles and the institution of slavery, which was then darkly alive and well in the United States. He lamented that Independence Day was certainly not a day of celebration for enslaved people. Yet he did not, he said, despair of this country. He instead saw hope, his word, based on the principles on which it was founded. He wrote and said, just as he saw, quote, forces in operation which must inevitably work the downfall of slavery, unquote, I'm suggesting that today we mobilize forces in operation which must inevitably work the downfall of injustice, authoritarianism, racism, sexism, homophobia, hatred, and bigotry. If I may quote a few passages, everyone should go and find this. It's available online. He spoke for quite some time, and the whole speech is worth reading carefully. He opened by saying, "Fellow citizens, pardon me, allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I or those I represent to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in the Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I therefore called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from our independence to us? Fellow citizens, above your national tumultuous joy, I hear the mournful wail of millions whose chains, heavy and grievous, yesterday and are today rendered more intolerable by the jubilee shouts that reach them." Unquote. And he goes on in that spirit. Only 23 years later, Susan B. Anthony spoke on July 4th, 1876. She released the Declaration of Rights of the Women of the United States, which the National Woman Suffrage Association had written. After the original declaration was read by several men at this celebration in Philadelphia, Susan B. Anthony and four of her associates rose from the audience uninvited and walked up to the stage and handed their woman's declaration to the host of the event. And then six of them went around to the front of Independence Hall, where Susan B. Anthony read the woman's declaration aloud. Quote, "We ask justice, we ask equality, we ask all of the civil and political rights that belong to citizens of the United States be guaranteed to us and our daughters forever." The declaration equated the woman's oppression by men with that of the American colonies by King George III. And she cited a litany of those grievances felt today, much as the declaration declared them as grievances against the colonies. And then we come down about 90 years later to a sermon by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. at Ebenezer Baptist Church. It was on that occasion in Atlanta that presciently, just with such foresight that Dr. King always brought to his thinking and to his sermons, he anticipated so much of Donald Trump's corrosive, racist, hateful ideology. In line after line, and this is another speech I urge listeners to find, and all of these speeches will be linked at LA Progressive Magazine in my inaugural article. And he refuted everything that Trump stands for. He began the American dream. And I choose this subject because America is essentially a dream. It is a dream of a land where men of all races and all nationalities, of all creeds, can live together as brothers. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. King went on, very seldom, if ever, in the history of the world has a socio-political document expressed in such profound, eloquent, and unequivocal language the dignity and the worth of human personality. For the American dream reminds us that every man is an heir of a legacy of worthfulness. But ever since the founding fathers of our nation dreamed this dream, America has been something of a schizophrenic personality. Schizophrenic personality. On the one hand, we have proudly professed the noble principles of democracy. On the other hand, we have sadly practiced the very antithesis of those principles. Indeed, slavery and segregation have been strange paradoxes in a nation founded on the principle that all men are created equal. But now, more than ever before, America is challenged to realize its noble dream, for the shape of the world today does not permit us the luxury of an anemic democracy. So every person of goodwill in this nation is called upon to work passionately and unrelentingly to realize the American dream. And the persons who are working to do this are not dangerous agitators. They are not dangerous rabble-rousers, but they are the persons working to save the soul of America. Unquote. Listen to those words as applied to the brave people in Minneapolis today. They are literally accused of being rabble-rousers and worse by the Trump administration. And Dr. King knew of what he spoke. He knew of how the civil rights movement had been so brutally and violently and deadly suppressed by Southern police forces. And yet today we see in the streets of Minneapolis Trump's version of the stormtroopers and of the Bull Connors and the repressive police forces that worked so tenaciously to suppress the civil rights movement in our country. Indeed, those police forces have been used to suppress every movement in American history. I've learned that the very origins of police departments were anti-slave renegade troops and militarized individuals who went after fugitive slaves, and that emerged into the modern version of American police forces. So it is these words of Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony and certainly Dr. Martin Luther King that we must recall. We cannot be silenced and have that history erased by President Trump and all of his enablers this year. Frankly, this year is a perfect example and a perfect opportunity to lift up these voices. Trump is putting billions of private and public dollars into his campaign to erase American history. He's done so much of it already, and now he feels he can wrap himself in the American flag in this 250th anniversary. As much as we take every other threat that he poses seriously, we have to take his threat to American history seriously. I think we're all up to that. I know that Law and Disorder Radio and Podcast is up to that. At LA Progressive, we're up to that. And I think this should be the spirit of Minneapolis this year, the spirit of the people across this country. I think we can put down this ugly revisionist history. We can breathe life into the spirit of the Declaration of Independence, which said that when a government is tyrannical, it can be removed. We've got to remove part of it during the midterm elections, and we've got to remove all of it in 2028.
Stephen, thank you for that. I'm certainly inspired. We know what our moral assignment is now. How can listeners follow your work?
Well, they certainly can go to LA Progressive this year, but I was pleased to discover that Muckrake, M-U-C-K-R-A-C-K, gathers up all my writings. That's very helpful. I never created my own website, and I encourage people to go there. And switching hats, I encourage them to listen to Law and Disorder every week.
Stephen Rohde, thank you for everything that you do and for being with us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
On a sub-zero afternoon on January 23rd, thousands gathered in Minneapolis to demand an end to ICE deportations and to confront the human cost of immigration enforcement. Faculty, students, union members, and community organizers stood shoulder to shoulder in a show of collective resolve. What made the day especially striking was how far people traveled to be there, many from out of state. A small button reading "Education, not deportation," captured the deeper message. This was not only about immigration policy, but about who belongs and whose labor is valued. The march occurred just one day before Minneapolis became the scene of another fatal encounter between federal immigration agents and a resident, 37-year-old ICU nurse Alex Preti. Joining us today is Shondor John, who traveled from New York City to be at the rally. Shondor is on the faculty of the City University of New York's Hunter College. He's a member of the Professional Staff Congress, faculty staff union there, and of that union's Immigrant Solidarity Working Group. Shondor, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Shondor, tell us about the mass protest in Minneapolis and why it was so important in action.
So this was a very, very large protest. Some people estimate about 50,000 people on Friday the 23rd in very bitter cold. It was approximately 20 degrees below zero. It is difficult to describe for somebody who's not used to that, like me. And I think that the significance of this is in large part what the onslaught being carried out by ICE, by DHS, by the Border Patrol is intended to do. And I think that a large part of it is intended to intimidate people, to terrify people, to scare people, to silence people, to show demonstrative brutality and sadism against immigrants as a spearhead of an attack on everybody's rights. And in that sense, I think that this very large protest and determined protest, this loud protest, showed that the people of Minneapolis are not intimidated, that they are not going to be silenced, and that they wanted to show defiance. And I think that that's something that has inspired a very large number of people around the country.
Shandor, please describe what you saw at these protests and other events, including at the airport.
I was there for several days. I wasn't there for a really long time. I saw almost from the beginning what this determination of people in Minnesota generally and in Minneapolis, what it is like. If you go to, you know, somewhere to get something to eat, you will very likely see signs saying, everybody welcome here except ICE. For example, me and a couple of friends went to a very famous breakfast spot, a diner that's been there for many, many decades. And they had a sign saying that. There are signs about the protest, signs are calling for a shutdown all over the place. The big demonstration on Sunday, the 23rd, as I mentioned, was very, very large. But that morning, a bunch of people from different unions, as well as religious leaders, et cetera, went out to the airport for a protest there. You know, in a lot of ways, it was kind of symbolic, but it was right out of Terminal 1 there. And it was also bitterly cold. There was a lot of determination there. There were some civil disobedience type arrests. Those arrests were actually carried out, as I recall, by the Minnesota State Police. You know, my understanding is that last night at the University of Minnesota, about 70 students were arrested by campus police. In terms of what happened after the murder, the execution of Alex Preti, the ICU nurse from Veterans Administration Hospital, together with some friends, we saw on social media that another person had been murdered by the DHS, in this case by Border Patrol. And we went over to Nicollet Avenue. It was Nicollet Avenue and 26th Street, which is very close to where he had been murdered. And I think many of us have now seen the videos. People gathered there. People built a kind of barricade. It wasn't exactly a barricade, but it was a huge dumpster where people were giving speeches. People were chanting. You could smell and taste the tear gas in the air. People were chanting their defiance. They were chanting their outrage. We still didn't know the name of this hero that we know now. And I think it's correct to call Alex Preti that. Soon people began to learn about him and to you know, chant his name. People were not intimidated. People were not silenced. People wanted everyone to know what the ICE Gestapo had done in this very, very bitter cold, where you, at least me and my friends, could not, you know, take off a glove for more than 30 seconds without feeling like we were going to have our hands freeze off. Mainly young people, but not only young people, and it's a very diverse community there, came out to protest and then returned again and again to protest. And we marched, you know, around several blocks in the neighborhood. People were chanting ICE out. And we have to recall that these killings, the murder of Renee Good, the murder of Alex Preti, this is about a mile from where George Floyd was murdered by the municipal police, you know, in 2020, which set off, described as the largest continuous protest in U.S. history of, if I recall, about 23 million people. Minneapolis has a tradition of struggle. Minneapolis is also where the 1934 general strike led by revolutionaries in the Teamsters Union at the time occurred. So there's a lot of tradition, but there's a determination to defeat this attack, which is an attack, really, I think, on all of us.
We know that the issue started with Trump's crackdown on immigration and expansion of ICE's authority. But the crisis and the issues have become much larger. What is this moment really about?
Well, first I would say that I feel that it's very, very important that people keep in mind that the apparatus of anti-immigrant repression and the apparatus of surveillance, the apparatus of all of the buildup of repressive forces has been very much a bipartisan thing. If we look at the buildup of anti-immigrant action by organizations like ICE, et cetera, the Border Patrol, it was Obama and Biden who paved the way, in my opinion, for, you know, what Trump is doing today. And I think that's really important to keep in mind. He is seeking to even outdo their record, but he is not starting from scratch. And if we look at institutions like the Border Patrol, some of my family, you know, lives in the Southwest. The Border Patrol is notorious for its racism against the Chicano population. They're going back for a very, very long time. But I think that right now what is happening is a drive towards what is sometimes called a strong state, sometimes called a Bonapartist regime in the Marxist vocabulary. It's certainly a drive towards authoritarianism, in which, again, as many of us had warned, the assault against immigrants is the wedge towards an assault against fundamental freedoms of the working people in general. I don't think that this can be defeated by playing within the framework of those political and social forces that paved the way for this.
You passed out buttons that read, education, not deportation. It's really a simple, powerful phrase. What's behind that slogan? What did you mean by as an educator and a union leader?
Well, I didn't really pass out buttons saying that. I had a few from our union, the Professional Staff Congress at CUNY. I think it's important that I state that I'm expressing my own views and I'm not speaking in the name of our union or as a spokesperson for the union on these matters. Although our union has what I think is very important and members of the union are very proud of it, an immigrant solidarity working group, an official group within the union to organize in defense of immigrant students, of immigrant teachers, of immigrant campus workers, of immigrant families, and to help the defense of immigrant communities. And the Immigrant Solidarity Working Group of the union produced this button that says education, not deportation. So I gave out a couple of those insofar as my fingers didn't totally freeze off. I had to take off my gloves to fellow union education union members at the big demonstration on Sunday, January 3rd, 23rd, particularly from some of the higher ed unions. Because we want to, among other things, I think it's important to encourage the formation of committees and working groups like that in every single union. And I'm also part of something called the Labor Committee to Defend Immigrants, which is a group that was started in early 2025 to bring together people from a whole bunch of different unions here in New York City, and there's also one in Portland, Oregon, but bringing together education workers, construction workers, Amazon, UPS, a lot of people from healthcare, immigrant rights activists, et cetera. And one of the things that we have been pushing a lot is for the formation of such committees. And I'll just say that within the United Federation of Teachers here in New York, activists, some of whom are part of the Labor Committee to Defend Immigrants, have built committees in some of the schools here, like in Roosevelt High School in Brooklyn, for example, for the defense of immigrants. And actually, we're able to get a put forward resolution in the United Federation of Teachers for union-led defense of immigrant students, teachers, and communities that passed by over 90%. So in a certain way, handing those buttons, giving those buttons out to a few colleagues was a way of expressing solidarity, but also helping to popularize or seeking to popularize some of these ideas. And they do actually have in the Minneapolis Federation of Educators, they have a committee for the defense of immigrant rights there too.
You addressed the crowd on January 24th, and you called for general strike, referencing that 1934 strike in the city. Tell us more.
So this was the location, very, very close, I think a half a block from where Alex Brady was murdered. And people were still trying to figure out what was going on. People were very upset, very angry. This is where they had gotten a kind of a semi-barricade built around a dumpster. And I said I was, you know, working in education in New York City and bringing solidarity. They lifted me up to stand up on this dumpster, and then they kind of had to hold on to me because it was slippery and it was cold. There has been a lot of talk about a general strike, and some people describe what happened on the 23rd as a general strike. And I wanted to address the issue of a general strike, partly from the standpoint of when there was this huge general strike in 1934 in Minneapolis, and partly from the standpoint of the needs of the struggle today. And what I said with regard to this question is that what is needed in Minneapolis, in my opinion, is a real general strike. And a real general strike means that the workers and their unions go out collectively. They exercise the fundamental right of the working class, of labor, to withhold our labor. And that the unions stand behind their members, back them up in taking this collective action. And that this collective action is general in the sense that it is not just one or two or three industries, but it's basically everything, and it succeeds in shutting it down. Meaning, transport is shut down. Commerce is shut down by the workers. Okay, production is shut down. I was a phone worker for a long time in Oakland. It would mean that we would, as phone workers, shut down communications or shut it down for the banks and the employers and the those who are on the other side of the class struggle. That's what a strike is, and that's what a general strike is. In 1934, that's what happened, and it was under the leadership of revolutionaries. It was actually the Trotskyists. There's a book about the Trotskyist Teamsters. It's called Revolutionary Teamsters. I really recommend it. These were hardcore, hard-bitten coal shovelers, mainly. They made their living shoveling coal in the very bitter winters in Minneapolis. And they had a class struggle outlook, and they had to deal with a very conservative Teamster bureaucracy that was not happy about this at all. But to get through the city, you had to have a pass from the union. When the scabs tried to break the strike, the workers stopped them. They exercised their power to stop them. There's a huge amount of potential power, including in the city of Minneapolis, where some really big companies have their headquarters and so forth. So I said that, in my opinion, there needs to be a real general strike, and that this isn't exactly the words, I don't think. But what is the obstacle to that, is that the labor leadership was saying, well, we can't break any no-strike clauses in our union contracts. That's where you have a contract that says we won't go on strike for the duration of the contract. So the union is tying its own hands. And when you have the ICE Gestapo and Border Patrol gunning down a man who, as an eminent speaker said a couple days later in a speech, a man who spent his life saving other people's lives and died doing the same on that street, the working class cannot just keep working. It needs to use its power. But that also means that you have to see, and this is something that I said, what's holding that back? And in my opinion, it's a political question in large part. And that is the subordination of the unions to the Democratic Party. And that's a case there. That's a case here. It's a case in Los Angeles. It's a case in Washington. It's a case in the cities that ICE has targeted. And I think that chain needs to be broken to bring out the power of the working class. And that was something that the leaders of the 1934 strike were really upfront about. They said, we need to have a workers' party, a revolutionary workers' party, because they were talking about a revolution by the working class. So I think these are some of the issues when you see the terrible repression, when you see the bankruptcy of the political system, which is a bipartisan thing. Everybody knows that these raise, really fundamental questions. So that was some of the stuff that I said, and I'm sure that I'm forgetting some of it. But I think that part of that is telling the truth about what is and what is not a general strike. So I think that what happened, on the 23rd was a really, really massive show of indignation. I want to say one thing in the process of organizing this. So the targets of this sadistic and brutal campaign are immigrants. Last year, 32 immigrants died in ICE custody. This year, at least 6 have died in ICE custody. A man was killed in Texas in ICE custody, and it's been ruled a homicide. All too often, though, in my opinion, we hear things about American citizens. Another American citizen has been killed. Well, it's an outrage when people are murdered by these repressive forces. But we have to remember that the struggle centrally is for immigrant rights as a part of defending everybody's rights. So I think that the next steps really do have to be a fight for a real general strike in Minneapolis, and to draw those lessons and be prepared to have a similar fight here in New York and elsewhere. I think that when we talk about strikes, we're talking about the huge majority of people that make their living by working. And that gives them a huge power. And that's true here in New York, where 45% of the population was born in another country. 45% of the workforce, was born in another country. Immigrants are a central part of the working class. So I think that this is the focus, to me, of that struggle. And that's a struggle for the political independence of labor as well, to break free from those political and social forces of capitalism and its parties and politicians that keep labor chained to the status quo. People are pretty fed up with the status quo. They're fed up with seeing this repression and racism. And they need to take action and to organize. So in terms of, there's different organizations. There's certainly the union that I'm part of and the Professional Staff Congress. If you look on its website and you look up Immigrant Solidarity Working Group, there's a lot of material about what the union is doing and resources about it. I'm part of something called the Labor Committee to Defend Immigrants. If people are interested, they can write to laborconference@gmail.com. And I'm also part of something called Class Struggle Education Workers, which is affiliated to or works together with, more accurately, the Internationalist Group, which is a Marxist organization. So people can look those up, online and see ways of getting in touch. But I think that it's really good that people are talking about, the question of a general strike. I hope people will read on their own about the 1934 general strike in Minneapolis. And I think that we have a huge task and struggles ahead of us. But if they think that we will be silenced and frightened, if they think that they can scare us into going along with or sitting by with, with our arms crossed in the face of them attacking our fellow workers and our immigrant students and communities and families and friends, they're wrong. We are going to defeat that, and we're going to do it through using the power that we have as workers.
Well, Shandor, thank you so much for this, for everything you do, and we really appreciate your taking time away. I know you're heading out to a protest now, so be safe on the streets, and thanks for your fine example.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on the show.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
going their own direction. Where they meet, they talk of uniting, but they won't just intersection.
The Neo Soul Songstress, and you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
It's a time of tremendous uncertainty for everyone, but some things haven't changed. Stomach cancer is still a leading cause of cancer death worldwide. More than 1 million people will be diagnosed this year alone, and it's vital to know your risks and learn ways to prevent it. It's also critical for cancer patients to protect themselves from all viruses. No Stomach for Cancer encourages you to listen to medical experts to understand your risks. Find out more about COVID-19 at cancer.gov and learn more about your risks for stomach cancer at nostomachforcancer.org.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Now, opening the vaults on over 100.